Dug into the slope, 100 feet below our camp, in an equally precarious setting, were the tents of most of the other teams, including Scott Fisher's group, the South Africans, and the Taiwanese. Early the next morning, Thursday, May 9th, as I was pulling on my boots for the ascent to Camp 4, Chen Yunan, a 36-year-old steelworker from Taipei, crawled out of his tent to evacuate his bowels, shod only in the smooth-soled liners of his mountaineering boots, a serious lapse of judgment. As he squatted, he lost his footing on the ice and went hurtling down the Lhotse face. Incredibly, after falling only 70 feet, he plunged headfirst into a crevasse, which arrested his tumble. Sherpas, who had seen the incident, lowered a rope, quickly pulled him out of the slot, and assisted him back to his tent. Although he was battered and badly frightened, he didn't seem seriously injured. At the time, nobody on Hall's team, including me, was even aware that the mishap had occurred. Shortly thereafter, Makalu Gao and the rest of the Taiwanese team left Chen alone in a tent to recover and departed for the South Col. Even though Gao had assured Rob and Scott that he wouldn't attempt the summit on May 10th, he'd apparently changed his mind and now intended to go for the top the same day we did. That afternoon, a Sherpa named Zhang Bu, descending to Camp 2 after hauling a load to the South Col, stopped at Camp 3 to monitor Chen's condition and found that the Taiwanese climber's symptoms had worsened significantly. He was now disoriented and in great pain. Deciding that he needed to be evacuated, Zhang Bu recruited two other Sherpas and began escorting Chen down the Lhotse face. 300 feet from the bottom of the ice slope, Chen abruptly keeled over and lost consciousness. A moment later, down at Camp 2, David Brashear's radio crackled to life. It was Zhang Bu, reporting in a panicked voice that Chen had stopped breathing. Brashears and his IMAX teammate, Ed Viesters, rushed up to see if they could revive him, but when they reached Chen some 40 minutes later, they found no vital signs. That evening, after Gao arrived at the South Col, Brashears called him on the radio. "Makalu," Brashears told the Taiwanese leader, "Chen has died." "Okay," Gao replied. "Thank you for the information." Then he assured his team that Chen's death would in no way affect their plans to leave for the summit at midnight. Brashears was flabbergasted. "I had just closed his friend's eyes for him," he says with more than a touch of anger. "I had just dragged Chen's body down, and all Makalu could say was, 'Okay.' I don't know, I guess maybe it was a cultural thing. Maybe he thought the best way to honor Chen's death was to continue to the summit." Over the preceding 6 weeks, there had been several serious accidents. Tenzing's fall into the crevasse before we even arrived at base camp, Nawang Topche's case of hape and subsequent deterioration, a young, apparently fit English climber on Mal Duff's team named Ginge Fullen, who'd had a serious heart attack near the top of the icefall, a Dane on Duff's team named Kim Sedgberg, who was struck by a falling serac in the icefall and broke several ribs. Until that moment, however, nobody had died. Chen's death cast a pall over the mountain as rumors of the accident spread from tent to tent, but 33 climbers would be departing for the summit in a few short hours, and the gloom was quickly banished by nervous anticipation of what lay ahead. Most of us were simply wrapped too tightly in the grip of summit fever to engage in thoughtful reflection about the death of someone in our midst. There would be plenty of time for reflection later, we assumed, after we had all summited and got back down. Chapter 12, Camp 3, May 9th, 1996, 24,000 feet. I looked down. Descent was totally unappetizing. Too much labor, too many sleepless nights, and too many dreams had been invested to bring us this far. We couldn't come back for another try next weekend. To go down now, even if we could have, would be descending to a future marked by one huge question. What might have been? Thomas F. Hornbein, Everest, the West Ridge. Arising lethargic and groggy after my sleepless night at Camp 3, I was slow to dress, melt water, and get out of the tent on Thursday morning, May 9th. By the time I loaded my backpack and strapped on my crampons, most of the rest of Hall's group was already ascending the ropes toward Camp 4. Surprisingly, Lou Kosicki and Frank Fishbeck were among them. Because of their ravaged state when they arrived in camp the previous evening, I'd assumed that both men would decide to throw in the towel. "Good on you, mates," I exclaimed, borrowing a phrase from the antipodal contingent, impressed that my cohorts had sucked it up and resolved to push on. As I rushed to join my teammates, I looked down to see a queue of approximately 50 climbers from other expeditions moving up the ropes, too. The first of them were now immediately below me. Not wanting to become entangled in what was sure to be a massive traffic jam, which would prolong my exposure to the intermittent fusillade of stones whizzing down the face from above, among other hazards, I picked up my pace and resolved to move toward the head of the line. Because only a single rope snaked up the Lhotse face, however, it wasn't easy to pass slower climbers. Andy's encounter with the falling rock was very much on my mind every time I unclipped from the line to move around somebody. Even a small projectile would be enough to send me to the bottom of the face if it struck while I was disengaged from the rope. Leapfrogging past others, moreover, was not only nerve-wracking, but exhausting. Like an underpowered Yugo trying to pass a line of other vehicles on a steep hill, I had to keep the accelerator jammed to the floor for a distressingly long time to get around anybody, leaving me gasping so hard that I worried I was going to puke into my oxygen mask. Climbing with oxygen for the first time in my life, I took a while to get used to it. Although the benefits of using gas at this altitude, 24,000 feet, were genuine, they were hard to discern immediately. As I fought to catch my breath after moving past three climbers, the mask actually gave the illusion of asphyxiating me, so I tore it from my face, only to discover breathing was even harder without it. By the time I surmounted the cliff of brittle, ochre-hued limestone known as the Yellow Band, I had worked my way to the front of the queue and was able to settle into a more comfortable pace. Moving slowly but steadily, I made a rising leftward traverse across the top of the Lhotse face, then ascended a prow of shattered black schist called the Geneva Spur. I'd finally gotten the hang of breathing through my oxygen rig and had moved more than an hour ahead of my nearest companion. Solitude was a rare commodity on Everest, and I was grateful to be granted a bit of it on this day, in such a remarkable setting. At 25,900 feet, I paused on the crest of the spur to drink some water and take in the view. The thin air had a shimmering, crystalline quality that made even distant peaks seem close enough to touch. Extravagantly illuminated by the midday sun, Everest's summit pyramid loomed through an intermittent gauze of clouds. Squinting through my camera's telephoto lens at the upper southeast ridge, I was surprised to see four ant-like figures moving almost imperceptibly toward the south summit. I deduced that they must be climbers from the Montenegrin expedition. If they succeeded, they would be the first team to reach the top this year. It would also mean that the rumors we'd been hearing of impossibly deep snow were unfounded. If they made the summit, maybe we had a chance of making it too. But the plume of snow now blowing from the summit ridge was a bad sign. The Montenegrins were struggling upward through ferocious wind. I arrived on the South Col, our launching pad for the summit assault, at 1 p.m. A forlorn plateau of bulletproof ice and windswept boulders 26,000 feet above sea level, it occupies a broad notch between the upper ramparts of Lhotse and Everest. Roughly rectangular in shape, about 4 football fields long by 2 across, the col's eastern margin drops 7,000 feet down the Kangshung face into Tibet. The other side plunges 4,000 feet to the western Kum. Just back from the lip of this chasm, at the col's westernmost edge, the tents of Camp 4 squatted on a patch of barren ground surrounded by more than 1,000 discarded oxygen canisters. Note: the spent oxygen bottles blighting the South Col have been accumulating since the 1950s, but thanks to an ongoing litter removal program instigated in 1994 by Scott Fisher's Sagarmatha Environmental Expedition, there are fewer of them up there now than there used to be. Much of the credit belongs to a member of that expedition named Brent Bishop, the son of the late Barry Bishop, the eminent National Geographic photographer who summited Everest in 1963. Who initiated a highly successful incentive policy, funded by Nike Incorporated, whereby Sherpas are paid a cash bonus for each oxygen bottle they bring down from the col. Among the companies guiding Everest Rob Hall's Adventure Consultants, Scott Fisher's Mountain Madness, and Todd Burleson's Alpine Ascents International have enthusiastically embraced Bishop's program, resulting in the removal of more than 800 oxygen canisters from the upper mountain from 1994 through 1996. End of note. If there is a more desolate, inhospitable habitation anywhere on the planet, I hope never to see it. As the jet stream encounters the Everest Massif and is squeezed through the V-shaped contours of the South Col, the wind accelerates to unimaginable velocities. It's not unusual for the winds at the Col actually to be stronger than the winds that rip the summit. The nearly constant hurricane blowing through the Col in early spring explains why it remains as naked rock and ice, even when deep snow blankets adjacent slopes. Everything not frozen in place here has been blasted into Tibet. When I walked into Camp 4, six Sherpas were struggling to erect Hall's tents in a 50-knot tempest. Helping them put up my shelter, I anchored it to some discarded oxygen canisters wedged beneath the largest rocks I could lift, then dove inside to wait for my teammates and warm my icy hands. The weather deteriorated as the afternoon wore on. Lopsang Jangbu, Fisher's Sirdar, showed up bearing a back-wrenching 80-pound load, some 30 pounds of which consisted of a satellite telephone and its peripheral hardware. Sandy Pittman was intending to file internet dispatches from 26,000 feet. The last of my teammates didn't arrive until 4:30 p.m., and the final stragglers in Fisher's group came in even later, by which time a serious storm was in full flower. At dark, the Montenegrins returned to the Col to report that the summit had remained out of reach. They'd turned around below the Hillary Step. Between the weather and the Montenegrins' defeat, it didn't augur well for our own summit assault, scheduled to get underway in less than 6 hours. Everyone retreated to their nylon shelters the moment they reached the Col and did their best to nap, but the machine gun rattle of the flapping tents and the anxiety over what was to come made sleep out of the question for most of us. Stuart Hutchison, the young Canadian cardiologist, and I were assigned to one tent. Rob, Frank, Mike Groom, John Taskey, and Yasko Namba were in another. Lou, Beck Weathers, Andy Harris, and Doug Hansen occupied a third. Lou and his tent mates were dozing in their shelter when an unfamiliar voice called out from the gale. "Let him in quickly, or he's going to die out here!" Lou unzipped the door, and a moment later a bearded man fell supine into his lap. It was Bruce Harrod, the amiable 37-year-old deputy leader of the South African team and the sole remaining member of that expedition with real mountaineering credentials. Bruce was in real trouble, Lou remembers, shivering uncontrollably, acting very spacey and irrational, basically unable to do anything for himself. He was so hypothermic he could barely talk. The rest of his group was apparently somewhere on the Col or on their way to the Col, but he didn't know where, and he had no idea how to find his own tent, so we gave him something to drink and tried to warm him up. Doug was also not doing well. "Doug didn't look good," Beck recalls. "He was complaining that he hadn't slept in a couple of days, hadn't eaten, but he was determined to strap his gear on and climb when the time came. I was concerned because I'd gotten to know Doug well enough at that point to realize that he'd spent the entire previous year agonizing over the fact that he'd gotten to within 300 feet of the summit and had to turn around. And I mean, it had gnawed at him every single day. It was pretty clear that he was not going to be denied a second time. Doug was going to keep climbing toward the top as long as he was still able to breathe." There were more than 50 people camped on the Col that night, huddled in shelters pitched side by side, yet an odd feeling of isolation hung in the air. The roar of the wind made it impossible to communicate from one tent to the next. In this godforsaken place, I felt disconnected from the climbers around me, emotionally, spiritually, physically, to a degree I hadn't experienced on any previous expedition. We were a team in name only, I'd sadly come to realize. Although in a few hours we would leave camp as a group, we would ascend as individuals, linked to one another by neither rope nor any deep sense of loyalty. Each client was in it for himself or herself, pretty much. And I was no different. I sincerely hoped Doug got to the top, for instance, yet I would do everything in my power to keep pushing on if he turned around. In another context, This insight would have been depressing, but I was too preoccupied with the weather to dwell on it. If the wind didn't abate, and soon, the summit would be out of the question for all of us. Over the preceding week, Hall's Sherpas had stocked the col with 363 pounds of bottled oxygen, 55 cylinders. Although that sounds like a lot, it was only enough to permit a single attempt for 3 guides, 8 clients, and 4 Sherpas. And the meter was running. Even as we reclined in our tents, we were using up precious gas. If need be, we could turn off our oxygen and safely remain up here for perhaps 24 hours. After that, however, we would need to either go up or go down. But Mirabil Visu, at 7:30 p.m., the gale abruptly ceased. Harrod crawled out of Lou's tent and stumbled off to locate his teammates. The temperature was well below zero, but there was almost no wind. Excellent conditions for a summit climb. Hall's instincts were uncanny. It appeared that he had timed our attempt perfectly.
"Jono! Stuart!"
he yelled from the tent next door.
"Looks like we're on, lads. Be ready to rock and roll at 11:30.
As we sipped tea and readied our gear for the climb, nobody said much. All of us had suffered greatly to get to this moment. Like Doug, I had eaten little and slept not at all since leaving Camp 2 days earlier. Every time I coughed, the pain from my torn thoracic cartilage felt like someone was jabbing a knife beneath my ribs and brought tears to my eyes. But if I wanted a crack at the summit, I knew that I had no choice but to ignore my infirmities and climb. 25 minutes before midnight, I strapped on my oxygen mask, switched on my headlamp, and ascended into the darkness. There were 15 of us in Hall's group, 3 guides, a full complement of 8 clients, and Sherpas Ang Dorje, Lhakpa Chiri, Nawang Norbu, and Kami. Hall directed 2 other Sherpas, Arita and Chuldum, to remain at the tents in support, ready to mobilize in the event of trouble. The Mountain Madness team, composed of guides Fisher, Beidelman, and Bukarev, 6 Sherpas, and clients Charlotte Fox, Tim Madsen, Clev Schoening, Sandy Pittman, Lenny Gamelgard, and Martin Adams, left the South Col half an hour after us. Note. Missing from Fisher's summit party were clients Dale Cruz, who had remained at base camp in the wake of his most recent bout with Hayes, and Pete Schoening, the fabled 68-year-old veteran, who'd elected to go no higher than Camp 3 after a cardiogram administered by Drs. Hutchinson, Taskey, and McKenzie had indicated a potentially serious anomaly in his heartbeat. End of note. Lopsang had intended that only 5 Mountain Madness Sherpas accompany the summit team, leaving 2 at the call in support, but he says, "Scott opens his heart, tells to my Sherpas, all can go to summit." Note. Most of the climbing Sherpas on Everest in 1996 wanted an opportunity to reach the top. Their underlying motives were no less varied than the motives of Western climbers, but at least part of the incentive was job security. As Lopsang explained, "After Sherpa climbs Everest, easy to find work. Everybody want to hire the Sherpa." End of note. In the end, Lopsang went behind Fisher's back and ordered one Sherpa, his cousin, Big Pemba, to remain behind. "Pemba angry to me," Lopsang acknowledged, "but I tell to him, you must stay or I will not give you job again." So he stays at Camp 4. Leaving camp just after Fisher's team, Makalu Gao started up with 2 Sherpas, blatantly ignoring his promise that no Taiwanese would make a summit attempt the same day we did. The South Africans had intended to go for the top 2, but the grueling climb from Camp 3 to the call had taken so much out of them that they didn't even emerge from their tents. All told, 33 climbers departed for the summit in the middle of that night. Although we left the call as members of 3 distinct expeditions, our fates were already starting to intertwine, and they would become more and more tightly bound with every meter we ascended. The night had a cold, phantasmal beauty that intensified as we climbed. More stars than I had ever seen smeared the frozen sky. A gibbous moon rose above the shoulder of 27,824-foot Makalu, washing the slope beneath my boots in ghostly light, obviating the need for a headlamp. Far to the southeast, along the India-Nepal frontier, Colossal thunderheads drifted over the malarial swamps of the Terai, illuminating the heavens with surreal bursts of orange and blue lightning. Within 3 hours of leaving the call, Frank decided that something about the day just didn't feel right. Stepping out of the queue, he turned around and descended to the tents. His fourth attempt to climb Everest was over. Not long after that, Doug stepped aside as well. "He was a little ahead of me at the time," recalls Lou. "All of a sudden, he stepped out of line and just stood there. When I moved up beside him, he told me he was cold and feeling bad and was heading down." Then Rob, who was bringing up the rear, caught up to Doug, and a brief conversation ensued. Nobody overheard the dialogue, so there is no way of knowing what was said, but the upshot was that Doug got back in line and continued his ascent. The day before departing base camp, Rob had sat the team down in the mess tent and given us a lecture about the importance of obeying his orders on summit day. "I will tolerate no dissension up there," he admonished, staring pointedly at me. "My word will be absolute law, beyond appeal. If you don't like a particular decision I make, I'd be happy to discuss it with you afterward, but not while we're on the hill." The most obvious source of potential conflict was the likelihood that Rob might decide to turn us around before the summit. But there was another matter he was particularly concerned about. During the latter stages of the acclimatization period, he'd given us slightly freer rein to climb at our own pace. For instance, Hall sometimes allowed me to travel 2 hours or more out in front of the main group. He now stressed, however, that for the first half of the summit day, he wanted everybody to climb in close proximity. "Until we all reach the crest of the southeast ridge," he pronounced, referring to a distinctive promontory at 27,600 feet, known as the balcony, "everyone needs to stay within 100 meters of each other. This is very important. We will be climbing in the dark, and I want the guides to be able to keep close track of you." Ascending through the pre-dawn hours of May 10th, those of us at the head of the pack were thus compelled to repeatedly stop and wait in the bone-cracking cold for our slowest members to catch up. On one occasion, Mike Groom, Sirdar Ang Dorji, and I sat on a snow-covered ledge for more than 45 minutes, shivering and pounding our hands and feet to ward off frostbite, waiting for the others to arrive. But the squandered time was even more excruciating to bear than the cold. At 3:45 a.m., Mike announced that we'd gotten too far ahead and needed to stop and wait yet again. Pressing my body against a shale outcrop, trying to escape the sub-zero breeze now blowing from the west, I stared down the precipitous slope and attempted to identify the climbers inching toward us in the moonlight. As they advanced, I could see that some members of Fisher's group had caught up with our group. Hall's team, the Mountain Madness team, and the Taiwanese were now jumbled into one long, intermittent queue. And then something peculiar caught my eye. 65 feet below, a tall figure in a bright yellow down jacket and pants was hitched to the back of a much smaller Sherpa by a 3-foot length of cord. The Sherpa, not wearing an oxygen mask, huffing loudly, was hauling his partner up the slope like a horse pulling a plow. The odd pair was passing other people and making good time, but the arrangement, a technique for assisting a weak or injured climber known as short roping, appeared to be hazardous and extremely uncomfortable for both parties. By and by, I recognized the Sherpa as Fisher's flamboyant Sirdar, Lopsang Jangbu, and the climber in yellow as Sandy Pittman. Guide Neil Beidelman, who also observed Lopsang towing Pittman, recalls, "As I came up from below, Lopsang was leaning into the slope, clinging to the rock like a spider, supporting Sandy on a tight tether. It looked awkward and quite dangerous. I wasn't sure what to make of it." Around 4:15 a.m., Mike gave us the go-ahead to resume our ascent, and Ang Dorji and I started climbing as fast as we could in order to warm ourselves. As the first hint of daybreak brightened the eastern horizon, the rocky, terraced terrain we'd been ascending gave way to a broad gully of unconsolidated snow. Taking turns breaking trail through the calf-deep powder, Ang Dorji and I reached the crest of the southeast ridge at 5:30, just as the sun edged into the sky. 3 of the world's 5 highest peaks stood out in craggy relief against the pastel dawn. My altimeter read 27,600 feet. Hall had made it very clear that I was to climb no higher until the whole group had gathered at this balcony-like roost, so I sat down on my pack to wait. When Rob and Beck finally arrived at the back of the herd, I'd been sitting for more than 90 minutes. As I waited, both Fisher's group and the Taiwanese team caught and passed me. I felt frustrated about wasting so much time and peeved at falling behind everybody else. But I understood Hall's rationale, so I kept a tight lid on my anger. During my 34-year tenure as a climber, I'd found that the most rewarding aspects of mountaineering derived from the sport's emphasis on self-reliance, on making critical decisions and dealing with the consequences, on personal responsibility. When you sign on as a client, I discovered, you are forced to give up all of that, and more. For safety's sake, a responsible guide will always insist on calling the shots. He or she simply can't afford to let each client make important decisions independently. Passivity on the part of the clients had thus been encouraged throughout our expedition. Sherpas put in the route, set up the camps, did the cooking, hauled all the loads. This conserved our energy and vastly increased our chances of getting up Everest, but I found it hugely unsatisfying. I felt at times as if I wasn't really climbing the mountain, that surrogates were doing it for me. Although I had willingly accepted this role in order to climb Everest with Hall, I never got used to it. So I was happy as hell when at 7:10 a.m. he arrived atop the balcony and gave me the okay to continue climbing. One of the first people I passed when I started moving again was Lopsang, kneeling in the snow over a pile of vomit. Ordinarily, he was the strongest member of any group he climbed with, even though he never used supplemental oxygen. As he proudly told me after the expedition, "Every mountain I climb, I go first. I fix line. In 95 on Everest with Rob Hall, I go first from base camp to summit. I fix all ropes." His position near the back of Fisher's group on the morning of May 10th, retching his guts out, seemed to indicate that something was seriously amiss. The previous afternoon, Lopsang had exhausted himself carrying a satellite phone for Pittman in addition to the rest of his load from Camp 3 to Camp 4. When Beidelman had seen Lopsang shoulder his crippling 80-pound burden at Camp 3, he'd told the Sherpa that it wasn't necessary to carry the phone to the South Col and suggested that he leave it behind. "I don't want to carry telephone," Lopsang later admitted, in part because it had worked only marginally at Camp 3 and it seemed even less likely to work in the colder, harsher environment of Camp 4. Note, the phone didn't work at all at Camp 4. End of note. "But Scott told to me, if you don't carry, I will carry. So I take telephone, tie on outside of my rucksack, carry to Camp 4. This makes me very tired." And now, Lopsang had just towed Pittman on a short rope for 5 or 6 hours above the South Col, substantially compounding his fatigue and preventing him from assuming his customary role in the lead, establishing the route. Because his unexpected absence from the head of the line had a bearing on the day's outcome, his decision to short rope Pittman provoked criticism and bafflement after the fact. "I have no idea why Lopsang was short roping Sandy," says Beidelman. "He lost sight of what he was supposed to be doing up there, what the priorities were." For her part, Pittman didn't ask to be short roped. As she left Camp 4 at the front of Fisher's group, Lopsang abruptly pulled her aside and girth hitched a bite of rope to the front of her climbing harness. Then, without consulting her, he clipped the other end to his own harness and began to pull. She maintains that Lopsang hauled her up the slope very much against her wishes, which begs a question. As a notoriously assertive New Yorker, she was so adamantine that some Kiwis at base camp nicknamed her Sandy Pitbull. Why didn't she simply unfasten the 3-foot tether connecting her to Lopsang, which would have required nothing more than reaching up and unclipping a single carabiner? Pittman explains that she didn't unclip herself from the Sherpa out of respect for his authority. As she put it, "I didn't want to hurt Lopsang's feelings." She also said that although she didn't consult her watch, her recollection was that he short-roped her for only 1 to 1.5 hours, not 5 to 6 hours, as several other climbers observed, and Lopsang confirmed. Note,
Pittman and I discussed these and other events during a 70-minute phone conversation 6 months after returning from Everest. Except to clarify certain points about the short roping incident, she requested that I not quote any part of that dialogue in this book, and I have honored that request. End of note. For his part, when asked why he short-roped Pittman, for whom he had openly expressed contempt on multiple occasions, Lobsang gave conflicting accounts. He told Seattle attorney Peter Goldman, who had climbed Broad Peak with both Scott and Lobsang in 1995 and was one of Fisher's oldest, most trusted friends, that in the darkness he had confused Pittman with the Danish client, Lainey Gammelgaard, and that he had stopped towing her as soon as he realized his mistake at daybreak. But in an extended tape-recorded interview with me, Lobsang insisted rather convincingly that he knew all along he was hauling Pittman and had decided to do it because Scott wants all members to go to summit, and I am thinking Sandy will be weakest member. I am thinking she will be slow, so I will take her first. A perceptive young man, Lobsang was extremely devoted to Fisher. The Sherpa understood how important it was to his friend and employer to get Pittman to the summit. Indeed, one of the last times Fisher communicated with Jane Bromet from base camp, he mused, "If I can get Sandy to the summit, I'll bet she'll be on TV talk shows. Do you think she will include me in her fame and fanfare?" As Goldman explained, Lobsang was totally loyal to Scott. To me, it's inconceivable that he would have short-roped anybody unless he believed very strongly that Scott wanted him to do it. Whatever motivated him, Lobsang's decision to tow a client didn't seem like a particularly serious mistake at the time. But it would end up being one of many little things, a slow accrual, compounding steadily and imperceptibly toward critical mass. Chapter 13. Southeast Ridge, May 10, 1996. 27,600 feet. Suffice it to say that Everest has the most steep ridges and appalling precipices that I have ever seen, and that all the talk of an easy snow slope is a myth. My darling, this is a thrilling business altogether. I can't tell you how it possesses me, and what a prospect it is, and the beauty of it all. George Lee Mallory, in a letter to his wife, June 28, 1921. Above the South Col, up in the death zone, survival is to no small degree a race against the clock. Upon setting out from Camp 4 on May 10th, each client carried 2 6.6-pound oxygen bottles and would pick up a third bottle on the South Summit from a cache to be stocked by Sherpas. At a conservative flow rate of 2 liters per minute, each bottle would last between 5 and 6 hours. By 4 or 5 p.m., everyone's gas would be gone. Depending on each person's acclimatization and physiological makeup, we would still be able to function above the South Col, but not well, and not for long. We would instantly become more vulnerable to HAPE, HACE, hypothermia, impaired judgment, and frostbite. The risk of dying would skyrocket. Hall, who had climbed Everest 4 times previously, understood as well as anybody the need to get up and down quickly. Recognizing that the basic climbing skills of some of his clients were highly suspect, Hall intended to rely on fixed lines to safeguard and expedite both our group and Fisher's group over the most difficult ground. The fact that no expedition had been to the top yet this year concerned him, therefore, because it meant that ropes had not been installed over much of this terrain. Göran Kropp, the Swedish soloist, had ascended to within 350 vertical feet of top on May 3rd, but he hadn't bothered to put in any ropes at all. The Montenegrins, who'd got even higher, had installed some fixed line, but in their inexperience they'd used all they had in the first 1,400 feet above the South Col, wasting it on relatively gentle slopes where it wasn't really needed. Thus, on the morning of our summit bid, the only ropes strung along the precipitous serrations of the upper southeast ridge were a few ancient tattered remnants from past expeditions that emerged sporadically from the ice. Anticipating this possibility, before leaving base camp, Hall and Fisher convened a meeting of guides from both teams, during which they agreed that each expedition would dispatch 2 Sherpas, including the climbing Sirdars, Ang Dorje and Lobsang, from Camp 4, 90 minutes ahead of the main groups.
This would give the Sherpas time to install fixed lines on the most exposed sections of the upper mountain before the clients arrived. Rob made it very clear how important it was to do this, recalls Beidelman. He wanted to avoid a time-consuming bottleneck at all costs. For some unknown reason, however, no Sherpas left the South Col ahead of us on the night of May 9th. Perhaps the violent gale, which didn't stop blowing until 7:30 p.m., prevented them from mobilizing as early as they'd hoped. After the expedition, Lopsang insisted that at the last minute, Hall and Fisher had simply scrapped the plan to fix ropes in advance of their clients because they'd received erroneous information that the Montenegrins had already completed the job as high as the south summit. But if Lopsang's assertion is correct, neither Beidelman, Groom, nor Bukharev, the three surviving guides, were ever told of the altered scheme. And if the plan to fix lines had been intentionally abandoned, there would have been no reason for Lopsang and Ang Dorje to depart with the 300 feet of rope that each Sherpa carried when they set out from Camp 4 at the front of their respective teams. In any case, above 27,400 feet, no ropes had been fixed ahead of time. When Ang Dorje and I first arrived on the balcony at 5:30 a.m., we were more than an hour in front of the rest of Hall's group. At that point, we could easily have gone ahead to install the ropes. But Rob had explicitly forbidden me to go ahead, and Lopsang was still far below, short-roping Pittman, so there was nobody to accompany Ang Dorje. Quiet and moody by nature, Ang Dorje seemed especially somber as we sat together watching the sun come up. My attempts to engage him in conversation went nowhere. His ill humor, I figured, was perhaps due to the abscessed tooth that had been causing him pain for the previous 2 weeks. Or maybe he was brooding over the disturbing vision he'd had 4 days earlier, on their last evening at base camp. He and some other Sherpas had celebrated the coming summit attempt by drinking a large quantity of chang, a thick, sweet beer brewed from rice and millet. The next morning, severely hungover, he was extremely agitated. Before ascending the icefall, he confided to a friend that he'd seen ghosts in the night. An intensely spiritual young man, Ang Dorje was not one to take such portents lightly. It was possible, though, that he was simply angry at Lopsang, whom he regarded as a showboat. In 1995, Hall had employed both Lopsang and Ang Dorje on his Everest expedition, and the two Sherpas had not worked well together. On summit day that year, Hall's team had reached the south summit late, around 1:30 p.m., to find deep, unstable snow blanketing the final stretch of the summit ridge. Hall sent a Kiwi guide named Guy Cotter ahead with Lopsang, rather than Ang Dorje, to determine the feasibility of climbing higher. And Ang Dorje, who was the Sirdar on that climb, took it as an insult. A little later, when Lopsang had climbed to the base of the Hillary Step, Hall decided to abort the summit attempt and signaled Cotter and Lopsang to turn around. But Lopsang ignored the command, untied from Cotter, and continued ascending to the summit alone. Hall had been angry about Lopsang's insubordination, and Ang Dorje had shared his employer's displeasure. This year, even though they were on different teams, Ang Dorje had again been asked to work with Lopsang on summit day, and again Lopsang appeared to be acting squirrely. Ang Dorje had been working well beyond the call of duty for 6 long weeks. Now, apparently, he was tired of doing more than his share. Looking sullen, he sat beside me in the snow, awaiting the arrival of Lopsang, and the ropes were left unfixed. As a consequence, I ran smack into the first bottleneck 90 minutes after moving beyond the balcony at 28,000 feet, where the intermingled teams encountered a series of massive rock steps that required ropes for safe passage. Clients huddled restlessly at the base of the rock for nearly an hour while Beidelman, taking over the duties of an absent Lopsang, laboriously ran the rope out. Here, the impatience and technical inexperience of Hall's client Yasko Namba nearly caused a disaster. An accomplished businesswoman employed by Federal Express in Tokyo, Yasko didn't fit the meek, deferential stereotype of a middle-aged Japanese woman. At home, she told me with a laugh, her husband did all the cooking and cleaning. Her quest for Everest had turned into a minor cause célèbre in Japan. Previously on the expedition, she'd been a slow, uncertain climber, but today, with the summit in her crosshairs, she was energized as never before. From the time we arrived at the South Col, says John Taskey, who'd shared a tent with her at Camp 4, Yosko was totally focused on the top. It was almost like she was in a trance. Ever since leaving the Col, she'd been pushing extremely hard, jostling her way toward the front of the line. Now, as Beidelman clung precariously to the rock 100 feet above the clients, the overly eager Yosko clamped her jumar to the dangling rope before the guide had anchored his end of it. As she was about to put her full body weight on the rope, which would have pulled Beidelman off, Mike Groom intervened in the nick of time and gently scolded her for being so impatient. The traffic jam at the ropes grew with each arriving climber, so those at the rear of the scrum fell farther and farther behind. By late morning, three of Hall's clients, Stuart Hutchison, John Taskey, and Lou Kosicki, climbing near the back with Hall, were becoming quite worried about the lagging pace. Immediately in front of them was the Taiwanese team, moving especially sluggishly. They were climbing in a peculiar style, really close together, says Hutchison, almost like slices in a loaf of bread, one behind the other, which meant it was nearly impossible to pass them. We spent a lot of time waiting for them to move up the ropes. At base camp, before our summit bid, Hall had contemplated two possible turnaround times, either 1 p.m. or 2 p.m. He never declared which of these times we were to abide by, however, which was curious, considering how much he'd talked about the importance of designating a hard deadline and sticking to it no matter what. We were simply left with a vaguely articulated understanding that Hall would withhold making a final decision until summit day, after assessing the weather and other factors, and would then personally take responsibility for turning everyone around at the proper hour. By mid-morning on May 10th, Hall still hadn't announced what our turnaround time would actually be. Hutchison, conservative by nature, was operating on the assumption that it would be 1 p.m. Around 11, Hall told Hutchison and Taskey that the top was still 3 hours away, and then he sprinted to try and get past the Taiwanese. It seemed increasingly unlikely that we would have any chance of summiting before the 1 p.m. turnaround time, says Hutchison. A brief discussion ensued. Kosicki was initially reluctant to concede defeat, but Taskey and Hutchison were persuasive. At 11:30, the three men turned their backs on the summit and headed down, and Hall sent Sherpas Kami and Lakbachiri down with them. Electing to descend must have been supremely difficult for these three clients, as well as for Frank Fishbeck, who'd turned around hours earlier. Mountaineering tends to draw men and women not easily deflected from their goals. By this late stage in the expedition, we had all been subjected to levels of misery and peril that would have sent more balanced individuals packing for home long ago. To get this far, one had to have an uncommonly obdurate personality. Unfortunately, the sort of individual who is programmed to ignore personal distress and keep pushing for the top is frequently programmed to disregard signs of grave and imminent danger as well. This forms the nub of a dilemma that every Everest climber eventually comes up against. In order to succeed, you must be exceedingly driven, but if you're too driven, you're likely to die. Above 26,000 feet, moreover, the line between appropriate zeal and reckless summit fever becomes grievously thin. Thus, the slopes of Everest are littered with corpses. Taskey, Hutchison, Kosicki, and Fishbeck had each spent as much as $70,000 and endured weeks of agony to be granted this one shot at the summit. All were ambitious men, unaccustomed to losing and even less to quitting, and yet, faced with a tough decision, they were among the few who made the right choice that day. Above the rock step where John, Stuart, and Lou turned around, the fixed ropes ended. From this point, the route angled steeply upward along a graceful arête of wind-compacted snow that culminated in the south summit, where I arrived at 11 to find a second, even worse bottleneck. A little higher, seemingly no more than a stone's throw away, was the vertical gash of the Hillary Step, and slightly beyond that, the summit itself. Rendered dumb with awe and fatigue, I took some photos, then sat down with guides Andy Harris, Neil Beidelman, and Anatoly Bukharev to wait for the Sherpas to fix ropes along the spectacularly corniced summit ridge. I noticed that Bukharev, like Lopsang, wasn't using supplemental oxygen. Although the Russian had summited Everest twice before without gas, and Lopsang thrice, I was surprised Fisher had given them permission to guide the peak without it, which didn't seem to be in their client's best interest. I was also surprised to see that Bukharev didn't have a backpack. Customarily, a guide would carry a pack containing rope, first aid supplies, crevasse rescue gear, extra clothing, and other items necessary to assist clients in the event of an emergency. Bukharev was the first guide I'd ever seen on any mountain ignore this convention. It turned out that he had departed Camp 4 carrying both a backpack and an oxygen bottle. He later told me that although he didn't intend to use the gas, he wanted to have a bottle handy in the event that his power was low, and he needed it higher on the peak. Upon reaching the balcony, however, he jettisoned the pack and gave his oxygen canister, mask, and regulator to Bottleman to carry for him. Because Bukharev wasn't breathing supplemental oxygen, he had apparently decided to strip his load down to the bare minimum to gain every possible advantage in the appallingly thin air. A 20-knot breeze raked the ridge, blowing a plume of spindrift far over the Kangshung face. But overhead, the sky was an achingly brilliant blue. Lounging in the sun at 28,700 feet inside my thick down suit, gazing across the roof of the world in a hypoxic stupor, I completely lost track of time. None of us paid much attention to the fact that Ang Dorje and Nawang Norbu, another Sherpa on Hall's team, were sitting beside us sharing a thermos of tea and seemed to be in no hurry to go higher. Around 11:40, Beidelman eventually asked, "Hey, Ang Dorje, are you going to fix the ropes or what?" Ang Dorje's reply was a quick, unequivocal, "No," perhaps because none of Fisher's Sherpas were there to share the work. Growing alarmed at the crowd stacking up at the south summit, Beidelman roused Harris and Bukharev and strongly suggested that the three guides install the ropes themselves. Hearing this, I quickly volunteered to help. Beidelman pulled a 150-foot coil of rope from his pack, I grabbed another coil from Ang Dorje, and with Bukharev and Harris, we got underway at noon to fix lines up the summit ridge. But by then, another hour had already trickled away. Bottled oxygen does not make the top of Everest feel like sea level. Climbing above the south summit with my regulator delivering just under 2 liters of oxygen per minute, I had to stop and draw 3 or 4 lungfuls of air after each ponderous step. Then I'd take one more step and have to pause for another 4 heaving breaths, and this was the fastest pace I could manage. Because the oxygen systems we were using delivered a lean mix of compressed gas and ambient air, 29,000 feet with gas felt like approximately 26,000 feet without gas. But the bottled oxygen conferred other benefits that weren't so easily quantified. Climbing along the blade of the summit ridge, sucking gas into my ragged lungs, I enjoyed a strange, unwarranted sense of calm. The world beyond the rubber mask was stupendously vivid, but seemed not quite real, as if a movie were being projected in slow motion across the front of my goggles. I felt drugged, disengaged, thoroughly insulated from external stimuli. I had to remind myself over and over that there were 7,000 feet of sky on either side, that everything was at stake here, that I would pay for a single bungled step with my life. Half an hour above the south summit, I arrived at the foot of the Hillary Step, one of the most famous pitches in all of mountaineering. Its 40 feet of near-vertical rock and ice looked daunting, but as any serious climber would, I'd wanted very badly to take the sharp end of the rope and lead the step. It was clear, however, that Bukharev, Beidelman, and Harris all felt the same way, and it was hypoxic delusion on my part to think that any of them was going to let a client hog such a coveted lead. In the end, Bukharev, as senior guide and the only one of us who had climbed Everest previously, claimed the honor, with Beidelman paying out the rope. He did a masterful job of leading the pitch. But it was a slow process, and as he painstakingly ascended toward the crest of the step, I nervously studied my watch and wondered whether I might run out of oxygen. My first canister had expired at 7 a.m. on the balcony, after lasting about 7 hours. Using this as a benchmark, at the south summit I'd calculated that my second canister would expire around 2 p.m.,
which I'd stupidly assumed would allow plenty of time to reach the summit and return to the south summit to retrieve my third oxygen bottle. But now it was already after one, and I was beginning to have serious doubts. At the top of the step, I shared my concern with Beidelman, and asked whether he minded if I hurried ahead to the summit, instead of pausing to help him string the last coil of rope along the ridge. "Go for it," he graciously offered. "I'll take care of the rope." Plodding slowly up the last few steps to the summit, I had the sensation of being underwater, of life moving at quarter speed. And then I found myself atop a slender wedge of ice, adorned with a discarded oxygen cylinder and a battered aluminum survey pole, with nowhere higher to climb. A string of Buddhist prayer flags snapped furiously in the wind. Far below, down a side of the mountain I had never laid eyes on, the dry Tibetan plateau stretched to the horizon as a boundless expanse of dun-colored earth. Far below, down a side of the mountain I had never laid eyes on, the dry Tibetan plateau stretched to the horizon as a boundless expanse of dun-colored earth. Reaching the top of Everest is supposed to trigger a surge of intense elation. Against long odds, after all, I had just attained a goal I'd coveted since childhood. But the summit was really only the halfway point. Any impulse I might have felt toward self-congratulation was extinguished by overwhelming apprehension about the long, dangerous descent that lay ahead. Chapter 14. Summit. 1:12 p.m., May 10th, 1996. 29,028 feet. Not only during the ascent, but also during the descent, my willpower is dulled. The longer I climb, the less important the goal seems to me, the more indifferent I become to myself. My attention has diminished, my memory is weakened. My mental fatigue is now greater than the bodily. It is so pleasant to sit doing nothing, and therefore so dangerous. Death through exhaustion is, like death through freezing, a pleasant one. Reinhold Messner, The Crystal Horizon. In my backpack was a banner from Outside Magazine, a small pennant emblazoned with a whimsical lizard that Linda, my wife, had sewn, and some other mementos with which I had intended to pose for a series of triumphant photos. Cognizant of my dwindling oxygen reserves, however, I left everything in my pack and stayed on top of the world just long enough to fire off four quick shots of Andy Harris and Anatoly Bukharev posing in front of the summit survey marker. Then I turned to descend. About 20 yards below the summit, I passed Neil Beidelman and a client of Fisher's named Martin Adams on their way up. After exchanging a high five with Neil, I grabbed a handful of small stones from a wind-scoured patch of exposed shale, zipped the souvenirs into the pocket of my down suit, and hastened down the ridge. A moment earlier, I'd noticed that wispy clouds now filled the valleys to the south, obscuring all but the highest peaks. Adams, a small, pugnacious Texan who'd gotten rich selling bonds during the booming 1980s, is an experienced airplane pilot who'd spent many hours gazing down on the tops of clouds. Later, he told me that he recognized these innocent-looking puffs of water vapor to be the crowns of robust thunderheads immediately after reaching the top. "When you see a thunderhead in an airplane," he explained, "your first reaction is to get the fuck out of there." So that's what I did. But unlike Adams, I was unaccustomed to peering down at cumulonimbus clouds from 29,000 feet, and I therefore remained ignorant of the storm that was even then bearing down. My concerns revolved instead around the diminishing supply of oxygen in my tank. 15 minutes after leaving the summit, I reached the top of the Hillary Step, where I encountered a clot of climbers chuffing up the single strand of rope, and my descent came to an enforced halt. As I waited for the crowd to pass, Andy arrived on his way down. "John," he asked, "I don't seem to be getting enough air. Can you tell if the intake valve to my mask is iced up?" A quick check revealed a fist-sized chunk of frozen drool blocking the rubber valve that admitted ambient air into the mask from the atmosphere. I chipped it off with the pick of my ice axe, then asked Andy to return the favor by turning off my regulator in order to conserve my gas until the step cleared. He mistakenly opened the valve instead of closing it, however, and 10 minutes later,
All my oxygen was gone. My cognitive functions, which had been marginal before, instantly went into a nosedive. I felt like I had been slipped an overdose of a powerful sedative. I fuzzily remember Sandy Pittman climbing past as I waited, bound for the summit, followed an indeterminate time later by Charlotte Fox and then Lopsang Jangbu. Yasuko materialized next, just below my precarious stance, but was flummoxed by the last and steepest portion of the step. I watched helplessly for 15 minutes as she struggled to haul herself up the uppermost brow of rock, too exhausted to manage it. Finally, Tim Madsen, who was waiting impatiently directly below her, put his hands beneath her buttocks and pushed her to the top. Rob Hall appeared not long after that. Disguising my rising panic, I thanked him for getting me to the top of Everest. "Yeah, it's turned out to be a pretty good expedition," he replied, then mentioned that Frank Fishbeck, Beck Weathers, Lucas Ishke, Stuart Hutchison, and John Taskey had all turned back. Even in my state of hypoxic imbecility, it was obvious Hall was profoundly disappointed that 5 of his 8 clients had packed it in, a sentiment that I suspected was heightened by the fact that Fisher's entire crew appeared to be plugging toward the summit. "I only wish we could have gotten more clients to the top," Rob lamented before continuing on his way. Soon thereafter, Adams and Bukharev arrived on their way down, stopping immediately above me to wait for the traffic to clear. A minute later, the overcrowding atop the step intensified further as Makalu Gao, Ang Dorji, and several other Sherpas came up the rope, followed by Doug Hansen and Scott Fisher. Then, finally, the Hillary step was clear. But only after I'd spent more than an hour at 28,900 feet without supplemental oxygen. By that point, entire sectors of my cerebral cortex seemed to have shut down altogether. Dizzy, fearing that I would black out, I was frantic to reach the south summit, where my third bottle was waiting. I started tenuously down the fixed lines, stiff with dread. Just below the step, Anatoly and Martin scooted around me and hurried down. Exercising extreme caution, I continued descending the tightrope of the ridge, but 50 feet above the oxygen cache, the rope ended, and I balked at going farther without gas. Over at the south summit, I could see Andy Harris sorting through a pile of orange oxygen bottles. "Yo, Harold," I yelled, "could you bring me a fresh bottle?" "There's no oxygen here," the guide shouted back. "These bottles are all empty." This was disturbing news. My brain screamed for oxygen. I didn't know what to do. Just then, Mike Groom caught up to me on his way down from the summit. Mike had climbed Everest in 1993 without gas, and he wasn't overly concerned about going without. He gave me his oxygen bottle, and we quickly scrambled over to the south summit. When we got there, an examination of the oxygen cache immediately revealed that there were at least 6 full bottles. Andy, however, refused to believe it. He kept insisting that they were all empty, and nothing Mike or I said could convince him otherwise. The only way to know how much gas is in a canister is to attach it to your regulator and read the gauge. Presumably, this is how Andy had checked the bottles at the south summit. After the expedition, Neil Beidelman pointed out that if Andy's regulator had become fouled with ice, the gauge might have registered empty even though the canisters were full, which would explain his bizarre obstinacy. And if his regulator was perhaps on the fritz and not delivering oxygen to his mask, that would also explain Andy's apparent lack of lucidity. This possibility, which now seems so self-evident, didn't occur to either Mike or me at the time, however. In hindsight, Andy was acting irrationally and had plainly slipped well beyond routine hypoxia, but I was so mentally impeded myself that it simply didn't register. My inability to discern the obvious was exacerbated to some degree by the guide-client protocol. Andy and I were very similar in terms of physical ability and technical expertise. Had we been climbing together in a non-guided situation as equal partners, it's inconceivable to me that I would have neglected to recognize his plight. But on this expedition, he had been cast in the role of invincible guide, there to look after me and the other clients. We had been specifically indoctrinated not to question our guide's judgment. The thought never entered my crippled mind that Andy might in fact be in terrible straits, that a guide might urgently need help from me. As Andy continued to assert that there were no full bottles at the south summit, Mike looked at me quizzically. I looked back and shrugged. Turning to Andy, I said, "No big deal, Harold. Much ado about nothing." Then I grabbed a new oxygen canister, screwed it onto my regulator, and headed down the mountain. Given what unfolded